We started this series of talks with the idea of going back to beginnings, in particular with regard to the Buddhist tradition. And we started with an account of the awakening that found in the Arya Parayatana Sutta, where the Buddha speaks of his waking up as a waking up to the dependent, contingent arising of things. And I'd like to return now to that point once again and start from there to see what happened next in his own life of a man on this earth. This experience of waking up, I think we can perhaps now see as the falling away, or the experience of a complete freedom from the constraints of Mara, of everything that hems us in, that blocks us, that prevents us from being fully and totally alive. And this, I feel, is likewise implicit in the idea of waking up to dependent origination, to contingency, is suddenly all of the blockages are gone, and one is exposed to the sheer, overwhelming outpouring of life itself. Now, in this respect, I'd like to suggest some ideas that some of you might find possibly slightly offensive, so you might want to block your ears. But please, this is just my own understanding, my own point of view. Within that which the Buddha opened himself up to, there was no God, no mind, no meaning, no purpose, no unconditioned something, but simply pure, unmediated pouring forth of events, rising and vanishing, constantly, without impediment, without interruption, overwhelmingly. And in this sense, an opening to what we might call the sublime, that which is beyond the capacity of our human mind to conceptualize, to understand in any kind of theoretical or rational way. This is something infinitely beyond, infinitely greater than our limited self is able to contain. It's a recognition that what we are, physically, emotionally, mentally, is likewise a configuration of that pouring forth of flux. It's tempting, and in some traditions this is very central to the whole practice, that we attribute to this greater infinite whole ideas such as that of God. We attribute to it ideas of meaning, that it's somehow directed towards a goal, that there's some sort of plan, some kind of purpose. But all such language is, in the end, anthropomorphic. In other words, we are attributing to something which is transhuman, human qualities. We can quite necessarily speak as a human action, something that we do, something that we say, as having meaning, as having purpose. But I think it's taking it too far. It's projecting human ideas onto something transhuman to speak of that as having a meaning or having a purpose. I find it unintelligible to speak of the universe or life, this sublime totality, as being meaningful or purposeful. And certainly to interpret it in any kind of quasi-personal way, that it somehow has a curious interest in me. I would also say it's just as mistaken to say that it is meaningless, purposeless. That's to project a negative value as opposed to a positive value. The point I think to bear in mind is that this is beyond all such categories, and to apply such categories is to slip into an anthropomorphic error. We're making it out as though it's a bit like us somehow, whereas in fact its transcendence, its sublimity, is precisely found in the fact that it is not like us. We are a consequence of it, but as we know now, the human being is the product of millions of years of evolution. We are very recent arrivals on this earth, and we may very soon depart. We are one of life's experiments. We may or may not survive. And I don't think we can read the world in all of its totality as somehow curiously human-like. The sublime, and again, this is an idea that has been developed in theology, I think particularly of Rudolf Otto, Das Heilige, the idea of the holy, is for me a very important idea. And it's what I feel is opened up in the experience of what we call emptiness. In the falling away, in the dropping away of this fixed idea of ego or self, we open ourselves to this endlessly fascinating and at the same time terrifying reality. The ego, in many ways, I feel, is a kind of anesthetic. It actually allows us not to feel that. And I think because when we do open ourselves to it, it is too overwhelming at times. Very often in Buddhism, and I think this is one of the problems of Buddhism, is that it tends to describe these experiences in cognitive terms. It's very cognitively biased. In other words, we talk about insight, understanding, knowing things. That seems to always be given privilege. And so when we experience selflessness, no self, we tend to think of this as coming to know something. Whereas in fact, such a moment of letting go is not just to do with what we know and don't know. It has as much to do with how we feel. In fact, I feel that as the self falls away, this fixed notion of self, which is a kind of grasping, a kind of closure, not only do we come to see things more clearly, which I feel also means to recognize their profound mysteriousness, but also we enter into another emotional relationship with life. The constriction of self is a way whereby we can close down to the suffering of the world. In the Vimalakirti Sutta, which is a Mahayana text, there are passages the Buddha is supposedly talking about emptiness, but he doesn't talk about understanding emptiness. He talks about tolerating emptiness. Tolerating. Being able to bear it. There's something unbearable about letting go of this protective anesthetic that we're so invested in. The pain of the world, the pain of life, the overwhelmingness and the grandeur of life can feel sometimes as though they're going to swamp us, bury us, destroy us, perhaps. And this is very much also the nature of the sublime. The sublime is both deeply attractive, fascinating, like when we look into the night sky or when we're on a small boat in the ocean. There's something deeply fascinating about that sheer grandeur and extent. But at the same time, that can quickly shift into a feeling of our insignificance, into a feeling of how we can just be swept away by it without any kind of malice, but simply through the powers of nature herself. A storm blows up, or an earthquake appears, and suddenly we're gone. We recognize our fragility. We recognize our the ephemerality of our life. We're like a little ephemeron, a little mayfly that's born for a day and then is dead. And yet, we find so much of our time is spent trying to deny that fact. And the self, I think, is shorthand for the strategies we employ to seal ourselves off from all that. So as these graspings and clingings fall away in what Buddhists call nirvana, we're also exposed to the world in another way. In a way that's sometimes very difficult to bear. I also feel that in this falling away of self, there is also an opening that we would call aesthetic. I think the dropping away of the self is also the opening to beauty, to the sheer, sheer almost ineffable beauty of life itself. I prefer really the word sublime, sublimity. For me, great art is more a seeking to give voice or form to the sublime than it is to the beautiful. For me, the works of art that move me most deeply are not those that are beautiful, but those that are sublime, that somehow bring forth in a painting or a piece of music that sense of the world that is beyond our capacity to conceptualize. Again, it's a sense of transcendence, a sense of going beyond our limits. So if we take the Buddha's awakening as something akin to what I've inadequately been trying to describe, I feel it also helps account for his immediate reaction. Namely, no one will understand this. This is simply not something I can put into words. And I don't think it's just because he didn't happen to have the language or the technical terms available. I think the very nature of the experience is such that it leaves us in a state of silence, a state of feeling dumb and mute. And so he sits beneath this tree. He hangs out. The texts talk of him spending a week under another tree and a week over there and a week there. And then something rather curious happens. And I'll just read the text. It says, and then bhikkhus, then monks, the Brahma Sahampati knew with his mind, the thought in my mind, namely that no one will understand me. And then, just as quickly as a strong man might extend his flexed arm, point, like that, the Brahma Sahampati vanished in the Brahma world and appeared before me. He arranged his upper robe on his shoulder, as gods do, and extending his hands in reverential salutation said, let the Blessed One teach the Dhamma. Let the Sublime One teach the Dhamma. There are beings with little dust in their eyes who are wasting through not hearing the Dhamma. Now, Brahma, as I'm sure you're aware, is one of the gods in Indian mythology. In fact, specifically, the god who is responsible for the creation of the world. Now, Vishnu then sustains it and Shiva destroys it. We have to ask ourselves, or at least I ask myself, what is this passage trying to tell us? What's going on here? Brahma appears to the Buddha periodically in a similar way that Mara does. Mara is the god of the realm of desire. Brahma is the lord, in Buddhist cosmology, of the realm of form. Not physical form, but ideal form. Somewhat similar, perhaps, to the Platonic ideas. Essential form, pure form. I don't believe that a god called Brahma descended from heaven in the way described here and then put his robe on his shoulder and started talking to the Buddha, any more than I believe that Mara comes along and has a little conversation and then goes off. These are ways of talking about, in mythological language, which I feel has to be preserved for its power. These are ways of talking about what's happening to the Buddha. And I understand this as the first step in his movement from formlessness to form. Now, Brahma plays an ambivalent role in Buddhism. As I mentioned already, sometimes the Buddha is very almost cynical about Brahma. You think you created the world? Well, you're wrong. But in other occasions, he preserves the idea of Brahma. For example, he talks about the Brahma Vihara, the abodes of Brahma, and the four of them. Metta, Karuna, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. So Brahma, in this context, I feel also is the emergence out of this formless, sublime state of love, of compassion. And again, what Brahma says suggests that there are people out there who will understand. It's a movement away from the experience of the sublime into an encounter once again with the world. Now, one of the doctrines we find in Mahayana Buddhism that I think is very, very important is the idea of the three bodies of the Buddha, the Trikaya, it's called. You don't find this idea in the Pali text. But what it's getting at, and this is why wherein lies its importance, is that it recognizes that what we call awakening or enlightenment is not understandable just as a private spiritual experience. that that idea, that I think is very common really, that the enlightened person is the one who's had something special happen inside him or her, has got some kind of special quality in their mind, but that's actually inadequate to understand what awakening is about. In the model of the three bodies of the Buddha, awakening is not, as it were, complete until it has manifested, it has found form in the world. In other words, it has been given voice, it has been given shape, it has been given content. And the way the three bodies work, effectively it's a theory of incarnation. From Dhammakaya, the Dhamma body, which is formless, to the what's called the Sambhogakaya, which is a tricky idea. The Sambhogakaya is in a sense the idealized form, the ideas, like Plato, a kind of vision of what could be, a vision of value, but not yet realized in the concrete social and historical place in which one lives. And we see these three stages very clearly described in this text, albeit in mythological language. We go from the formlessness of just being there with the pouring forth of the ineffable life itself, then the emergence of the first form, Brahma, creation, love, compassion, and then Brahma saying, look, there are people out there who might understand you. And this then prompts the Buddha to get up from his seat in Bodh Gaya and walk to Benares, cross the river, walk 8 miles north to Sarnath, or Isipatana as it was called then, and then walk into a park and see his former friends and start speaking. And it's at that moment when he opens his mouth, when he puts into words, and again, not words just in his own head, but words that are then heard by other human beings, that the Dhamma begins. And the awakening is then, as it were, realized. It's now achieved its culmination. It's now complete. And that sets in motion, as the texts say, the wheel of Dhamma. In other words, this insight, this understanding, this way of being is now given away. The act of awakening is also, in the end, an act of dana. The Buddha speaks of dana as the giving of material things, the giving of protection and safety, but for him the greatest dana giving, generosity, is the giving of the Dhamma, of what of values and ideals and practices that can actually help transform people's lives to give them meaning and value and purpose and freedom and insight and so on. And so the turning of the wheel of Dhamma is the ultimate act of generosity. And in doing so, he's giving himself away. He's imparting ideas and so forth that he then no longer has any control over. He's releasing them into the world. And I think in many ways, this model is more akin to the artistic process than it is, say, to the application of a particular technique, let's say. I think the process of writing, the process of painting, the process of creating something that has not been expressed quite in that way ever before, is rather comparable to what's going on here. We start in a kind of formless, unconstructed frame of mind, in which a certain idea, a certain inspiration comes forth, and at a certain point we make a mark on a piece of paper, or on a canvas, or whatever it might be, or on a musical score sheet. And at that moment, it's no longer mine. It's gone into the public domain. If I drop dead from a heart attack that moment, that's what will be left. And that can continue after my death to have reverberations, consequences that I cannot foresee, I cannot predict, and I cannot control. And in many ways, this turning of the wheel of Dhamma is not some heroic event that occurred 2,500 years ago, and since then the Dharma has just been sort of chugging along. But rather, I think we can see this in every moment of the Buddha's life, and perhaps in every moment of any awake life. Each time we speak, each time we write, each time we act, even the way we present ourselves to others in the world, the way we look at people, the way we give embodiment to our inner values, that is a giving away, a turning of a Dharma wheel, if you wish. It's an ongoing process. As soon as it becomes identified as, you know, the beginning of Buddhism, something we then have to preserve, something crucial about it, in other words, its living quality, becomes compromised. And if you think about it, the preservation of things, like the preservation of Buddhism, you only preserve things that are already dead. An apple that you've picked from a tree and you preserve in a jar. The living continuity of these values and teachings is found in the ongoing response that each of us has in each moment to the world. Sometimes we get it totally wrong. Sometimes we make the most ghastly mistakes. But the nature of our life is such that we are constantly called upon, even when we don't want to respond to life and to the world. We also, I think, have to note that Buddhism, like any other phenomenon in the world, is impermanent, unsatisfactory, empty, contingent, selfless. There's a danger, and I think this applies to all religions, of trying to somehow seal a religious teaching or a religious institution, to seal it off from impermanence, to regard it as being somehow perfect, not affected by contingencies. We try to preserve it. We want it not to change. We're very scared that someone might come along and find fault with it or criticize it. We want to hold on to it as one thing in this world that is a beacon of goodness and light. It can be that, of course. But we do need, I think, to be careful not to close down around our own religious beliefs, our own religious institutions, but to somehow find ways to make them live. And that implies a constant engagement, a constant encounter with the world as it actually is now. And how from that tradition do we find ways of living, ways of doing that are true to the values embodied in it, that are also appropriate and effective in the new situation that presents itself to us in each moment. And I think in Buddhism we see this very clearly. We have a tradition that's flourished in Asia over hundreds and hundreds of years, and suddenly it finds itself in a new situation. And when encountering, say, the suffering of the world, what do we do? Or what do I do, more to the point? Very often I find myself repeating Buddhist platitudes. Don't worry, it's impermanent. Instead of actually empathizing with the suffering of the person and allowing that to call forth a response that is appropriate to that situation, instead of seeking refuge in a body of beliefs or ideas that I might have inherited from Buddhism, sometimes that works, but very often I find my Buddhism can be something that closes me off from the world. It makes me dysfunctional. And I feel the challenge in my own practice is to somehow find ways to let go of Buddhism in order to respond to the world as it is, in a language and in a form that's appropriate to our time. And part of this process is the process of what one might call self-creation. Again, this idea of no self has often given rise to the idea that we're supposed to somehow negate ourselves. Now, I think this is a big mistake. I was talking about this yesterday, the idea of how, in fact, we find images of the self as being like an unformed piece of wood that needs to be fashioned. We also find, quite frequently in the text, and certainly in one of the earliest texts, the Sutta Nipata, an idea the Buddha has of the self as being something which we create. It's not something that is given. And the famous passage is, a person is not born a Brahmin, a person becomes a Brahmin by what he or she does. And then he goes on and says, a farmer is not a farmer because he's born a farmer, but a farmer is a farmer because of what he does. And likewise, a king, a craftsman, and so forth and so on. All of these roles, all of these identities, are things that we create through our acts. There's no given identity at birth. Now, this is a radical break with Vedic society, which saw the four castes, the Brahmins, the warriors, the merchants, the laborers, as being divinely ordained, as being reflect, being parts of the body of God. And the Buddha said, no, we create ourselves by our acts. In modern philosophy, this is sometimes called a performative conception of self. Performative. In other words, we are the consequences of our actions. We perform, and that is who we are, is our performance in the world. And of course, it's always social. It's through interaction that we, as it were, refine and define who we are in this world. So the notion of no self, I think we need to see as strategic rather than descriptive. It's also something to do, to become aware of and to try to release that tight grip of egoism that, although it seems to give us an identity, in fact prevents us from becoming what we could become. It's also curious to note that the Buddha doesn't abandon the idea of the Brahmin, for example, that he turns it on its head. It's not a fixed state, but it's something you can become. All people can become Brahmins, or priests, or spiritual people, if you wish, or religious teachers. There are a number of texts that point us in this direction. And one of the better known ones is that of the, which occurs right before the Buddha's death, when he says to Ananda, be an island to yourself, Ananda. have yourself as your refuge. In other words, atta, atman, self. That, in the end, is your only refuge, yourself. An island. In other words, this is an image of autonomy. Sometimes it's translated as lamp or light. The problem here is that the word in Pali, dīpa, can mean both. Scholars have told me that in comparison with Sanskrit versions, it's probably island. I think we can probably use both terms. But again, it's very much an emphasis on self-reliance. And it's telling, particularly when we see this statement in the context of where the Buddha was when he said it and the events of his life of that time. This is very much a kind of final injunction when the chips are down, as we say in English. When the Buddha's, at the end of the Buddha's life, his world broke apart. The political powers went to war. His main disciples died. Shakya was destroyed, was invaded, and the Shakyans were killed in an act of genocide. And he tries to get back to Shakya to die. But he doesn't quite make it. And this statement is made when he's on his way back home. He's just had a severe illness at Vaishali when he nearly died. He's with, it seems, only Ananda and Anuruddha, possibly Mahakunda, Sariputta's elder brother. A small group of a man who once was the counselor of kings and is now very much on his own, very much abandoned, moving back to his homeland, sick and ill and dying. And it's then that he says, be an island to yourself. In other words, you know, when the world breaks down, there's only one thing really you can rely upon, and that is, truthfully, he says, yourself, and particularly the Dhamma. He doesn't say depend on the Sangha. The Sangha's all dispersed at this point. They've all gone away. What can help in such moments is the integration in your own life of your deepest values, the realization of what matters for you most, not as a belief, but actually as a living experience. That is your true refuge. I remember one of the verses we used to recite when I was a Tibetan Buddhist monk. And again, it said that it described the Dhamma as the Kyat Na in Tibetan, which means the real refuge. The real refuge. The Buddha's dead. The Sangha might disperse. All that's left is your commitment, your life, founded on your own realizations. There's also the idea, again I've mentioned it, when he trained his monks, he encouraged them, in a phrase that's repeated quite frequently in the Pali text, to go forth into the world for the welfare of the many, for the benefit of the many, and let no two of you follow the same path. Again, it's a vision of self-reliance, a vision of autonomy, a vision of each person taking responsibility to create themselves. That, I feel, is his vision of what a human being can be, of what a self can be. And not some kind of, you know, elimination of all notion of self and becoming a kind of enlightened machine. And we find a similar idea, or an entirely compatible idea, in his vision of society. And I think the most beautiful expression of this is found in a text, only occurs once. It's found in the Vinaya, in the monastic rule, in which he compares his community to the ocean. And he says, just as the great rivers of the world pour into the ocean, and their waters merge without distinction. So do the great classes or castes of humankind pour into my Sangha, and their distinctions are lost and they merge in the sea or the water of my Sangha. Now when he says Sangha here, he's not talking just about the community of monks and nuns. It's monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen. And this seems to be a suggestion of a vision of what society could be like. A society that's not governed or defined in terms of caste or class difference, but a society that is fundamentally egalitarian, where each person is understood not in terms of their status or their birth or the role they might have, but simply in terms of their freedom to become what they are able to emerge as. And again, in the following sentence of this metaphor, he says, and just as the ocean is pervaded by the taste of salt, so is my community pervaded by the taste of freedom, of moksha. Now sometimes this is quoted as saying, the Dharma is pervaded by the taste of freedom. But no, he's actually talking about the community. In other words, he sees a community composed of self-creating individual persons who are free to become what they can potentially realize. And a Sangha or a community or a society is likewise held together through the network of relationships which provide support. Some people might say, well, you know, surely this is a very individualistic model. I think in some ways it is. I think one of the major breaks the Buddha makes with Indian society is by introducing the notion of the autonomous individual, which for many Buddhists has sound odd in light of the idea of no self. The problem is also that this social vision of the Buddha more or less was forgotten, and it certainly was not realized. When you go to India today, you find exactly the same caste structure that was in place 2,500 years ago. The constitution of the Republic of India, written in the 1940s and 50s, denies that this has anything to do with India, but spend a little time in India and you'll realize that it's the name of the game. So the Buddha's vision of what his society, or what Indian society could become, was not realized. In that sense, he was a failed social visionary. His teaching became almost entirely a question of individual transformation and liberation. And that's often, what's almost entirely how it's presented to us now. But my own sense is that he had a far greater vision than simply that of transforming the person. He had a vision as to how our social world could be should we live together, work together in creating such a kind of society. And so I understand this as being a society in which we work together to support each one of us in the optimization of our potential. A community is vital because it gives us the support to become ourselves. A community is not about, therefore, a kind of merging of differences into a kind of collective body where everybody thinks and feels the same way. That's not community. Martin Buber, in one of his books, in English it's translated as Between Man and Man, talks very interestingly of the difference between a collective and a community, very much on these lines. He's responding, of course, to communism, in which the individual is dissolved into the greater totality of the state. Buddha's vision, and I think it's very close to the Buddha's vision, is a recognition that community is a crucible, it's a embossure, it's a cradle for nurturing individuation. And again, individuation not as a kind of egoism, individualism, but rather an emergence of each person out of the matrix of their conditions into an increasingly differentiated person. It's also, I think, worth bearing in mind at this point that the Buddha, when he saw his own monastic community, he likewise did not see that as a community that was governed by a leader. Again, in the Mahapanibbana Sutra, this text I've been referring to his last month, he's asked, you know, when you're dead, who do we look to for guidance? And he says, you look to the Dhamma for guidance. The teaching is what will govern the life of the community, not an appointed successor. He refuses to appoint a successor. When Devadatta, his cousin, about 8 years before his death, says to him, look, you're really old now, I think you should retire and put me in charge, the Buddha says, Devadatta, I wouldn't give the leadership of the community to Sariputta or Moggallana, his main disciples, let alone to a god of spit like you. In other words, he saw the Dhamma really as, and it is translated this way sometimes, as a law, as a kind of a body of principles and values according to which the community would regulate its life, regulate and solve its disputes. But of course that's not what happened. Within, it seems, probably 9 months of the Buddha's death, Mahakasapa was put in charge. And he became known as the father of the Sangha. Now that, of course, basically means he was the first pope. Pope means father. Papa. Upapa. Upapa Kassapa. And, or the patriarch. So this is quite at odds with actually what the Buddha had in mind. And yet, you know, the way things work is that human institutions tend to want to have someone in command. The Buddha didn't want that. And I think also one of the reasons he refused to speak in terms of a split-level reality of an absolute truth and a relative truth, which is again an idea that came in very quickly after his death, is because once you make that split, once you make that division, that dualism, then you set in place the foundations for an authoritarian form of social governance. In other words, the person who is somehow speaking from the absolute truth is the one who then has authority, as opposed to those of us mired in mere relativities and conventions, confused as we are, can now look to this embodiment of the absolute truth and receive our guidance from them. The two-truth model, I think, gives the metaphysical frame for an authoritarian kind of leadership and communal life. So, if we try to bring this back to today, in the light of the various things I've been exploring and suggesting over the last few days, it leads me to the need for a thoroughgoing secular Dharma or secular Buddhism, one that abandons all of these dualities, between an absolute reality and a conventional reality, an unconditioned as opposed to a conditioned, and also a mind somehow separate from a body. But to recognize that we're all in this together, that this world that we inhabit may be the only world there is, and that ever has been and that ever will be. This little globe of matter going round this sun, that image, I feel, that we first had with the first space flight is really, I think, the defining metaphor of our age. The sense that we may be totally alone, or if there are other forms of life, they're so many light years away that we'll never be able to have any contact with them anyway. And this, I think, is a powerful spiritual shift in human awareness. And particularly now, as we recognize how fragile this world is, and how our behavior, driven, as the Buddhists would say, by greed and hatred, threatens to destroy it, or at least to severely damage it, then we can no longer, I think, afford the luxury of projecting our spiritual life into some state after death. But I don't really believe that you can have an engaged Buddhism and at the same time believe in reincarnation and other realms. Because however compassionate and however dedicated you might be to working to make this world a better place, at the end of the day, if it goes up in a nuclear explosion, or whether it's destroyed by pollution and global warming, it doesn't really matter. Because every sentient being on Earth will just get born somewhere else. But there's always this escape clause, this opt-out, which I think makes it difficult, if not impossible, to give one's life totally and unconditionally to the suffering and the plight of this globe, of this planet, and of the creatures, human and otherwise, that have come into being upon it. And likewise, I feel that to address these kinds of issues, which are not those that can be reduced to being problems for Christians or Jews or Muslims or Buddhists, we recognize that our potential Sangha, perhaps our actual Sangha, includes all of these people. That we can no longer, as was the case even 100 or so years ago, think of our lives as just that of our small local community. That we are part of a community, of an economy, of a culture, of a global, increasing global web that is impacted by the action of any bit of it. We have to move, I think, out of our parochial perceptions and beliefs and attachments into a more global consciousness, morally, ethically, spiritually. And that, I think, is the great challenge of our time. Because if we can't do that, then I don't think the future looks terribly bright. And to this extent, I'm not sure that religious institutions are really the way to go. What we need, I feel, is more a culture. We might call it a culture of awakening, that is not exclusively tied to Buddhism or any other religious tradition, but is founded on and gives voice to these primary concerns and values that we don't just find in the Buddhist teaching, but in all traditions. The languages differ, of course, but I think the core values are very often the same. So I'll conclude there, and we'll have an opportunity this afternoon to pursue some of these ideas further if we wish in the discussion. But I also need to remind you to look at the schedule for today that is posted on the board. It looks the same at a glance, but it's actually got Wednesday written on it. Wednesday's today, in case you weren't aware of that. And we've altered the afternoon schedule to include at 5 o'clock a Dana talk. And that means that the schedule will be the same until at 2:30 Martin will dive or will sit here for a meditation until 3:15. 3:15 to 4 we'll have walking. But at 4 o'clock the discussion will only be for, well, how does it go? 4 o'clock there'll be a sitting for 30 minutes to 4:30, and the discussion will be from 4:30 to 5. So we're chopping off 15 minutes of that. And at 5 o'clock, we'd be grateful if you could all be here, even if you miss everything else, for the Dana talk and then the Dana practice that will follow that. Thank you. Mahabharata. Mahabharata.